And hello again, I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And let's now turn to a second opinion, if you will, on China. We'll be joined by James Fellows, an award-winning author and national correspondent for The Atlantic. Previously, he was a speechwriter for Jimmy Carter and editor of U.S. News and World Report. He lived in Beijing recently for 3 years, wrote a book about it, Postcards from Tomorrow Square, Reports from China. He also made an Emmy Award-winning documentary called Doing Business in China. I'm speaking with James Fellows, who recently spent 3 years in China, and he's been back for 1 year and about to go back again. Clearly, James Fellows, you must find the place fascinating.
Yes, I think nobody would say it's an easy place to live, but it is an interesting place, and so my wife and I are diving back in for another dose.
What was your take on the meeting here in the last few days? I mean, clearly it had to go better than particularly the Bush summit there, where rather than give a Chinese leader a state dinner, they gave him a state lunch, and then they played the Taiwanese national anthem, and then the Falun Gong woman harangued him from the press corps, and then Bush manhandled. It was just a catastrophe. But this one wasn't immune from glitches. They had a problem in their press conference yesterday. Nobody could seem to hear anything. And of course, instead of simultaneous translations, we had laborious translations.
It's true. There was that misunderstanding. Apparently, the main misunderstanding was on President Obama's part, where he had assumed it was going to be simultaneous translation, and so he had a quite long opening answer and then realized it was going to be consecutive. And I think in the whole range of things that can go right and wrong, that probably is the only identifiable glitch that happened, that both in the symbolism, this was certainly as respectful a greeting as the U.S. could have given to President Hu Jintao, but I think without any of the overtones that some people to I think an excessive degree detected a year ago, when President Obama went to Shanghai and to Beijing and was seen as being a supplicant to the Chinese, and I think there was none of that tone either. So I think it was actually a successful visit.
And do you think that there's a lot of jokes about who's in charge and as opposed to who's on first? What do you make of that debate? I mean, clearly we're speaking earlier with Susan Shirk, who wrote a book about how the West and Western scholars overestimate China's being this juggernaut that's taking over the world, and the Chinese leaders are actually much more humble than that. They're always looking over their shoulder, trying to deal with riding the tiger of internal problems as opposed to external ambitions.
I would certainly agree with her on that. And it is interesting that all the attention from the U.S. side is essentially on two metrics, two related metrics. One is the size of these Chinese surpluses and the investments they've made in treasury notes and other kinds of U.S. Securities, which, of course, is money that's not being spent or invested inside China. It's being loaned or invested here. And the other is the manufacturing success of China, which, of course, is the backbone of what they've achieved. But here are one or two things to bear in mind. President Obama mentioned one of them almost offhandedly at the press conference yesterday when somebody was asking him about Chinese superiority. And he said, it's worth remembering that America's economy is still three times as large as China's, with one-fourth as many people. And it's either one-fourth as many to produce it or one-fourth as many to divide it among. And I think the Chinese are very acutely aware that they are still, on average, a very poor country, just down on the ranks in average income with many African countries, et cetera, despite their tremendous dynamism. The other is what Chinese leaders refer to as comprehensive national power. If you take all the different dimensions of what makes a nation influential, certainly manufacturing success, which the Chinese have, is one of those, and financial surpluses is another one. But military strength is an important one, where there's no comparison between the U.S. and China. The attractiveness on the world stage of where people want to emigrate. You know, people want to come to the U.S., and people like to work in China, but not to emigrate there. University systems, corporate brands. Think how many brand names you can name for Chinese corporations, and you cannot name many. I could name, 15 from Korea and 50 from Japan and hundreds from Europe. And so there are incomprehensive national power. I think the Chinese are aware that they still are a developing nation.
Again, I speak with James Fowler, the Atlantic Monthly's national correspondent, who recently spent 3 years in China. He's been back for a year and is about to return to China. That doesn't mean, though, James Fowler, that there's a lot of press over here about the emerging Chinese military threat. As soon as Bob Gates talks about cutting 100 or 200 billion off the defense budget, suddenly we're seeing Chinese missiles and stealth fighters. And I'm not sure that that China's strategic nuclear posture is particularly threatening. But what is your take on? Obviously, if you're going to have a successful economy, there's going to be a little more money for the military. But
sure.
But what do you think they are doing in terms of priorities, and how much are we either watching them with reason or exaggerating the threat?
I think, let me mention the two areas where I think it is worth being cautiously alert about the Chinese military, and then the other areas where I think there's an exaggerated impression. One is there are suspicions both within China and from China observers around the world that there are some tensions between the military and the civilian control inside China. It's not a well-integrated command system. There's not this thoroughgoing civilian command that you have in most other nations of the world. And so from time to time, there are suspicions that the military is sort of going off on its own, and that's why there's been so much speculation about the stealth fighter. Did President Hu know about that, et cetera? The other thing to be alert to is that Taiwan, while probably that's going to be just a peacefully developing situation between the mainland and Taiwan, it's potentially a very dangerous situation, because if there were an independence movement in Taiwan, a government in Beijing would have to react against that, and the government of the U.S. would have to react against that. So those are two things to be cautious about. In other ways, I think it's worth recognizing, again, still how enormous the difference is. Here's one illustration. The U.S. first developed an aircraft carrier in the 1920s between the world wars. The Chinese are preparing for their very first aircraft carrier. It still is some years away, and it takes years of experience to learn how to operate these, to have just the skills for naval aviation, for all the various ways of having carrier groups, et cetera. This stealth fighter is thought to be a long way from being a serious impediment, and it may even be that by the time it came to operations, that Western militaries would have moved to some post-stealth strategic situation where they wouldn't be relying so much on aircraft anyway. The military in China, one other point, the U.S. military is strong in part because it's always fighting. We know the downsides of always fighting. The upside is that the doctrine and everything is always tested. The Chinese have not really fought in 30-plus years since they had a battle against the Vietnamese.
Which didn't go well, by the way.
No, they were very, very badly beaten, and they lost about half as many men, many soldiers, within 1 month of fighting as the U.S. did within 10 years against the Vietnamese. So, again, one takes China seriously, but it's important to have a measured view of where they stand.
And James Fellows, what about the human rights issues, which we're told were brought up? And I noticed that at the state dinner last night, Kenneth Ross, the head of Human Rights Watch, was there. Do you think there was any sort of is this a ritual, or do you think there's some real progress, if that's the right word?
I think it's more than a ritual, but less than an actual bargain or area where changes can be made. Since the time the U.S. first normalized relations with China under Jimmy Carter and Deng Xiaoping 30-plus years ago, the understanding from the U.S. side has been, on the one hand, we think it's better to try to work with China than to work just against them, to consider them a potential partner rather than a certain enemy. On the other hand, there are areas where we really disagree. It's not like dealing with the Europeans. One of the things we most disagree about is the nature of their internal liberties and liberty, freedoms of speech, freedom of movement, freedom of political assembly, and all the rest. And I think that if it appeared, so American presidents since the time of Jimmy Carter have consistently made that point. We think we need to work with China, but nonetheless we disagree about the constraints on people's freedoms, various freedoms inside China. If there came a time when it looked as if China were systematically moving backward on that front, I think it would be cause a reassessment. It has been, I would say, over 30 years, a uneven and partial and halting moving forward. There are some really terrible and egregious cases, like the Nobel Prize winner, Mr. Viau, who's arrested without good reason. On the other hand, anybody who's seen China over the years would say that most people's lives are freer now than they were 15 years ago, than they were 10 years ago. Whether they're freer than 2 or 3 years ago, I don't know. But I think it's the central area of disagreement now between the U.S. and China, and I'm sure President Obama made that clear.
So given that you spent 3 years there and that one of the ways that we're sort of finding out better about China, albeit through a filter, James Fellows, is the Internet traffic. And we also know that Google pulled out in protest to interference from the Chinese government. Mm-hmm. But the some of the stuff that you hear, I recall reading some stuff recently about tensions with North Korea, where a lot of Chinese were referring to the North Korean, the son of the leader in waiting, if you will, as fatty and quite derisive, and why do we support these people, and they're a nuisance and a burden. But on the other hand, I believe that the Chinese government hires thousands of people to scour the internet for dissidents, and they also pay these people 50 cents for planting propaganda stories. How do you navigate through that?
I think that, like many things in China, contradictory trends are true at the same time. On the one hand, it's true that there is a lot of dissent in different parts of the Chinese internet, and there's lots of areas where there doesn't seem to be any real control on what people can say and what they can do. On the other hand, in totality, the internet and the media and the educational system are pretty effectively controlled by the government in China. And the brilliance of the internet firewall in China, the so-called Great Firewall, is that it's not a perfect or complete or totalitarian block. If you really want to get through it, there are always ways you can. You can pay a small amount for services that get you around, et cetera. But most people don't bother doing that. Most people in China just live within the accepted media environment, and so it is effective shaping most people's views of most topics. So I think that there are little always little areas popping up for criticism on various topics, but on the whole, on issues that really matter to the government, it's able to steer how the discussion goes.
So your wife Deborah, in her book, described a lot of the feeling of being on the street there, of being in a sea of people and people spitting and the friction and the abrasiveness and all of that stuff. And of course, she also described the other side, the more quieter side and more peaceful side, if you will. But my sense of it is that there is a real social division developing there. Not that we're without sin here in the United States in terms of the disparity of wealth, but I believe that the disparity of wealth is increasing greatly. The difference between the coastal regions and the inland are increasing greatly. The difference between the government, or the attempt to form a government, and the Communist Party apparatus is creating a kind of cleavage as well. So how do all these sort of cleavages in that society pan out or translate from your experience?
They certainly are the main factor that's on the Chinese government's mind. And you're right in saying that, of course, the U.S. has become an extremely polarized society economically. But by most economic measures, the Chinese polarization is more, because they do have some people who are as rich as American billionaires, and they have so many people who are a week type income poor people out in the countryside. So it is a genuine issue. And I think it's why, if a Chinese government official were here right now, he'd say, yes, and this is why we are trying so hard to boost our exports, and this is why we take such a tough line in economic policy, because we have these hundreds of millions of people who are just trying to get up from peasant existence, and we have to keep life moving ahead for them. I think on the whole, my impression is that if you asked, if you could poll all 1.3 billion people and ask them how their life compares with 30 years ago and also 10 years ago, compared with 30 years ago, almost everybody would say, yes, things are so much better. Compared with 10 years ago, most of them would probably say, yes, things are better too, because there's been so much modernization in that time and more jobs. The government's fear is that a year from now or 3 years from now or 5 years from now, most people will think things are not getting better because inflation has gotten worse, because they can't keep up with expenses, because they're being priced out of things. You know, and so I think that is what adds the edge to the Chinese government policy, that as long as people feel they're getting better, even if some people are getting much richer than they are, then there's one kind of consensus or consent for the system. But if people start to feel that they were moving back, they don't have ballot box redress for that. But I think the government is very sensitive to the kinds of discontent that could arise.
Just finally, James Fellows, how do you think the changes and the evolution of China's society, which is in economic terms been quite miraculous, how do you think it's going to start translating into foreign policy? And, of course, when we talk about human rights, we're very concerned about Burma, we're very concerned about North Korea and feel that the Chinese aren't pulling their weight. They seem to be playing a positive role now in the establishment of the southern Sudan, where they have oil interests.
Right.
But my sense is that as they get more internationalized, if you will, they're going to be more cooperative. But how do you rate them, and how do you rate the progress towards recognizing the need to cooperate against rogue regimes?
I think your word progress is the crucial one here, because it would be more convenient from the Chinese government's point of view if they never had to think about these things, if they could just stay with their announced policy of non-interference in other people's affairs, and therefore they say you don't interfere with us, which allows them just to pursue commercial interests with Sudan, with Burma, with whoever else. And I think that an inescapable counterpart of their increasing wealth and power and position in the world is that they're not going to be able to get away with that anymore. And the world in general will be saying that, will be placing expectations on them which come with increased power. And so I think that the rest of the world needs to accept the fact that China will be having more say and more influence in these regards. And I think the Chinese government will be coming increasingly to the realization that they have to do things too, even though it would be more convenient not to. There's not a lot of average person interest in these matters at all, as far as I can tell. People in China, like the U.S., are more inward than outer looking, and they're still just trying to get ahead economically. But I think as a natural concomitant of its overall development, there'll be both more pressure and more willingness to be involved in these ways.
I thank you so much for joining us here today in Los Angeles, James Fellows.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Bye-bye. And again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking then with James Fellows, an award-winning author, national correspondent for The Atlantic. Previously, he was editor of U.S. News and World Report. He lived in Beijing for 3 years. He wrote about it, Postcards from Tomorrow Square, Reports from China. Also won an Emmy for a documentary, Doing Business in China. Let's take a brief station break, and we'll come back and talk about the anniversary of the Citizens United decision and protests that are planned for tomorrow in Washington, D.C.